Our speaker today is John D, and he'll be sharing on emotional sobriety for 15 minutes. Take it away, John.
Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm really glad you're here. And thank you very much, Sally, my dear friend, for asking me. And hopefully you can hear me okay. To me, my face looks a little small on the screen, but that's fine. Okay, so I heard a comment somebody made at a BBA meeting, and that's kind of the catalyst for what I'm going to talk about today. They made a statement that I don't agree with, but you know, that happens, and I understand the impetus behind it. And I'll tell you a little about my background in a minute. But the statement was, they started the sentence with "God is not," which is a tricky way to start a sentence. But what they said was, God is not a feeling. And I think we need to be careful about limiting what God is and isn't. God is absolutely, profoundly, and deeply a feeling. In our book, it talks about feelings and emotion. It says they're the tissue out of which our lives are constructed. It says they determine the course of our existence. But it makes sense that if we have a circle and triangle approach that says body, mind, and spirit, that we might do a spiritual bypass on our heart, which is what I did in my early BBA days. I came to this work in 1994, 93, 94, when the BBA was being written. I was close for a while to Dan Sherman and Joe Hawk and some of the other sort of luminaries. And Sally did ask me to talk about, I don't know that there's enough time, but the fact that I'm going through this work again with you guys in a big Zoom group and then a small homework group on my codependency and my fixer controller, what we used to call Al-Anon issues. So, and I am a member of Al-Anon, and I think it's worthwhile inviting God into these other arenas of my life. I've been sober from drugs and alcohol since 1993. I'm really grateful to have been introduced to this work early on, but I did see some of my fellows like Mark, who died essentially from his addiction to cigarettes, smoking cigarettes, the embolism. And then Joe, who sort of ate himself to death and kind of fell off the path a little bit. And Dan too, who had some challenges with eating. And at the time, these secondary, we called them secondary addictions in AA, were kind of taboo. Our idea was that the big book solves it all. We don't need to have a first step experience with these other experiences because we're already connected to God. That was our theory, and we were wrong. And it's absolutely worthwhile addressing these secondary addictions because they can, some of them can kill you. And so nowadays, I'm really excited that the BBA and all these other approaches are looking at these other issues. You know, when I first was going to the meeting where the BBA was written, this is how we were forced to identify in your first couple of weeks there. I'd have to say, "Hi, my name is John, and I'm finding out what I am." That was the humility approach, right? It was like, "My name is whatever, I'm finding out what I am." So we didn't put a label on ourselves. Our idea was that we would find our own truth and have a deep first step experience, a profound experience with our truth to find out, am I really an alcoholic? We found out some of the people in our group had never gotten drunk in their lives. They were identifying as alcoholics. They were sharing at AA meetings, but they had never gotten drunk. They'd never lost control. They'd never had a blackout. They never had an addictive response to alcohol. They were pure, hardcore heroin addicts or cocaine addicts. And that's part of how these idiot guides were developed. It was like, let's do the same thing for these people that have drug problems and let them have a first step experience and not have to change every other line in the big book. Let's form an idiot's guide. And Craig in Arizona, and who ended up overdosing and dying, that's a whole other story, but came out with these other guides to make another approach on these so-called secondary, or in some cases were primary addictions. So I've been around this work for a long time. I'm grateful that I got exposed to it early in my sobriety. I'm grateful for my sponsor and all the experiences I've had. And so what I wanted to talk a little bit about was I'll just sometimes it's helpful to use a metaphor of sorts. There's an old story, and Ken D was an old AA speaker that used to tell it, which was this idea about how do you sense the presence of God, right? And it was, he made this analogy. He said, there was this kid on the beach, and he's got this string, and he's got a string, but it's cloudy, and he can't see anything up there. And the guy asked him, you're flying a kite, but how do you even know the kite's up there? You can't see anything. Are you sure it's there? And the kid says, yeah, I can feel the pull of it. I can feel the pull of it. So it's kind of like I can feel the pull of God because God is absolutely a feeling. Don't let anyone tell you it's not. That's a very important part, mind, body, spirit, and emotion. And if you don't address the emotion, you'll be going to 100 emotional sobriety workshops for the rest of your sobriety, trying to figure it out, trying to reach a point that we're meant to reach the first time around of emotional awareness, emotional intelligence, emotional resilience, and emotional integration. Part of the trouble with an addiction is that it becomes a rapacious creditor in a really odd way. It erodes our ability to withstand emotional states. Like I'll want an escape from my emotional state, right? My emotional state, like boredom, like loneliness, even like hunger or anger or frustration. There'll be different states that you go through. And there's this idea, I know how to feel better now. I know what I can eat now where I'll feel better. I know what I can try to fix or control. I know what drug I can take to feel better now. And as time goes on, it erodes the ability to withstand regular emotional states that people build resilience around. So I think this idea that we're going to make a mental approach to the program and figure it out with our mind is problematic, right? I mean, my mind is a good servant, but it's a bad master. Because when I make an approach to the steps and I'm trying to do an intellectual process, which sometimes happens in some of these big book groups, I'll make this approach with my mind, and my mind is going to try to win the game. It's a horror to find out that you can't surrender with your mind, and to find out that the only tool for surrender is your heart. It needs to be a change of heart, not a change of mind. There needs to be a heartfelt, sincere, real change in the emotional body. Now, I'm not saying in your first few months of sobriety, you should just do what you feel like all the time. I think there's a misunderstanding of that. It's like, if I did that, I don't know if I would have got out of bed my first year. So I'm not talking about being driven by, kind of twisted emotions. I'm talking now to people who've been at this for a while, and maybe have got a little breathing room away from their addiction or whatever it is that's plaguing them. And there's this elusive idea around emotional sobriety. And to me, if I'll accept and move towards the idea, the God idea works, the other ideas didn't work. The idea that God is absolutely a feeling. It talks about in the big book, the way to establish faith in God is through the feeling, the worshipful feeling you have for a flower or a sunset, right? I think that we don't live in a thinking world. My brain tells me we do, but we actually live in a feeling, in a vibrational world. That's part of the reason, as a tribal species, that the energy at some of the meetings, if you go to live meetings and online meetings, there's some kind of unaccountable energy that happens, a transformative energy. That happens to be a feeling. It's not a thought. And in fact, I'd even take it further that if you only use your mind as the tool to approach, and it's cause and effect, and you're going to figure it out and get the steps right and win the game and create your relapse prevention program, a lot of times it doesn't always work as well as we'd like. And part of that, to me, is what happens is kind of a side effect. I'm inviting God into this area of my life, and I'm going to take a series of steps, but I'm not getting myself or making myself sober by winning the game and figuring out how to fix myself by doing the steps the right way. It's a continual surrender and death of the ego that allows a little chink in my intellectual armor for God to come in. And he comes in through my heart, and he comes in like a feeling. Don't let anyone tell you God's not a feeling. Oh my God, I shuddered in horror when I heard that. God is everything or he's nothing. Let's be careful about what we're limiting God to. God's not this and God's not that. I don't know about that. God's everything. I have a book, a couple books on my shelf, When God Becomes a Drug. God is not a drug. And I'm not so sure about that. I don't even know about that either. I think some of us need an antidote, you know, for our affliction. And the antidote is God. And at least part of that, ideally, we're at an emotional sobriety meeting here, has to do with my emotional body, with my emotional resilience. So, any plan of recovery that leaves out the body we feel is incomplete. I think it's something like that in the doctor's opinion. Our book is not a textbook. That's a nice way to take it, and it's a useful abstraction, but it's not. I've edited textbooks. You know, I'm a college professor. I've written a textbook, and it's not a textbook. This is a sacred text, which is more profound and bigger and more important. It means that it's timeless, because textbooks in 5 or 10 or 20 years, they become obsolete. The big book is absolutely not obsolete, right? And other sacred books I could talk about have not become obsolete. If anything, a lot of them have become more profound and more important to people and to the world as a solution. So if I was to look at it as a sacred text, it means it's a living document and it changes over time. And it means that a phrase like, any plan of recovery that leaves out the body we feel is incomplete can change over time too. It means one thing: I have an addictive response, a bodily craving of the body is the way abstraction that they use in BBA. And to say later on that my body is a temple and that I shouldn't be leaving out any plan of recovery that leaves out my body and especially my emotions later on, we feel is incomplete, right? So some of my fellows early on in the BBA process, when it was being written, abandoned the idea of the body being a temple. And they had found a formula that always worked. If you finished your amends and you did all of this, and I'd never seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed our plan. And then one by one, I saw a whole bunch of people who followed the plan perfectly and went out and got loaded again. And you could really see what was happening. That it was a mental exercise and their ego grasped onto the spiritual principles and fortified them like an armor and they became unteachable. Hey man, you've gained about 65 pounds this year and the way you're eating, it's really like, maybe you should look at, no, I know what I'm doing. God's on my side. I figured out I have the BBA and blah, blah, blah. So there was this reluctance early on, which is so grateful the way this has evolved and this meeting that you can have any addiction and come here. Whoa, that was so taboo before. Yeah, some of you people have been around know that. So it's like, yes, I have the humility to accept I've got some codependent issues. I tried to fix my younger brother from his addiction, especially hard when it's family members, right? Al-Anon stuff. My father had a bad drinking problem. And I thought, oh, this is great. Easy solution. I couldn't help them. And I hit my bottom with a girlfriend that couldn't stop drinking. And it was early on in the relationship. And I was so relieved when I found out her major issue was drinking, because I thought, oh, this is going to be a cinch. I'm already sober. All I have to do is get her to come to some meetings and I'll get her a sponsor and, you know, I'll get her a meeting schedule so she can stay on track and I'll just help a lot. It was an absolute fail. And the frustration of that fail brought me to my knees. It was horrible. I remember my first Al-Anon meeting, I started crying. I'd never cried at an AA meeting. I was about 8 years sober. And I was just like, and this woman came up, this older, much older kind of grandmotherly lady, and did something that doesn't happen a lot in AA. She just rubbed my back really gently. And she said something like, thank you. She said something like, you're gonna be okay. Or, you know, it was a really profound experience. My emotional body got opened up because I hit a bottom with something and I realized I couldn't do anything to fix these people around me in my life. So I also was to realize later on in going through this work, I just went through 1, 2, and 3 in a homework group for this issue, that this could also kill me. This could also kill me. The neglecting self-care, trying to fix everyone, I had just someone call me with a job offer, which I don't want to take. And he's like, John, you'd really be helping us out. And I was talking to my friend. We were walking on the beach. I have a friend visiting from out of town. And I said, in the past, I would always say yes. I'll take this assignment for a couple months because I need to help this agency out. They're really in a pinch, and they've helped me out. And I was like, no. And I had this overwhelming guilt, like, oh, I'm letting them down. And they've taken the time to contact me and put this package together. And it's like, no, I don't want to do this. It's crappy money. It's a crappy job. It's not a good fit for my skills. I've already have two jobs, three jobs, and I've have to study for this licensure for this other job. And so it's like, so I'm growing in leaps and bounds going through this work again. I feel most of the time aligned with my higher power and with you guys. It doesn't mean that I always do what I feel like, but there's a formula, there's a secret ancient formula that I'll share with you guys for now how to apprehend knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. And this is the formula. It says, conform not to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Thus you will uncover God's secret will for you, perfect, simple, and beautiful. So the way I practice that in my life is in the morning. Do I wake up an alcoholic that needs God, or I wake up just a regular guy that needs to get stuff done? So when I wake up, before I turn the TV on, before I turn my computer on, before the phone goes on, first I pray, then I meditate. It's 10 minutes of loving myself, right? It's 10 minutes of connecting with my higher power before I engage, the worldly clamors, right, that could throw me off. I read something spiritual, I meditate, I make my bed, I pray, and they're heartfelt prayers. There are 12 prayers I read every morning. And I feel like after that, I've put God first. I've started to connect to this formula that never fails. The God idea works. And I'm able to enter, the world in harmony with my environment. God's got my back. I'm reminded of this relationship, this step three agreement, which maybe I didn't take so seriously, but maybe my higher power did. Maybe I just thought, well, I'll make this thing, but maybe the other party to the contract took it very seriously. I think I've changed my mind. God has decided and will not change his mind. You are now a light worker forever in the sacred tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Period. Whatever happens, you drink, you work with others. If you've taken the third step prayer and the third step with your whole heart, you're going to be operating on a different level. It requires everything you've got, but you've got everything you need. And one of the things it requires is a heartfelt, sincere, emotionally based feeling attachment to a feeling God. If I leave that out, if it's just an intellectual exercise, it has no real traction. And I know that guys I work with. I'll say one last thing. I think we're wrapping up towards the end, but some years ago, I was going through the BBA again, and I went to make amends to my recent ex-girlfriend, who I was kind of almost not quite still with, but I was seeing someone else. And so I went to make the amend, and I've shared this with some of you folks before. And I was halfway through the amend, and I actually had a little 3x5 card. And some of us make amend deep amends. Is there anything I left out? Do you want to tell me how that made you feel? What can I do to make things right? I'm halfway through the amend, like a good soldier, doing what I'm supposed to do with my mind. And she says, stop. Stop talking. There's no emotion in what you're saying. Your eyes are dead. You're crossing me off a list somewhere, off of a list. There's no feeling. There's no sincere feeling of apology in your eyes or in your body or anything. And she said the thing that ended up changing my life. She said, you're dead inside, like you've always been. You might be sober, but you're dead inside. And she was right. And shortly after that, out of nowhere, I was helping a guy newer than me in the program. And he said, can you help me do this intimacy workshop? And I'm like, no, I'm not good with intimacy. I'm not into that. I don't, I, you know, I'm a Gen X. We invented social distancing and perfected it. Okay. So I'm like, I'm not into that. I don't, he's like, please, it would mean a lot to me. So I reluctantly went to this thing. And at the end, he said, oh, I think we've got time to do this meditation. So we do this meditation. And at the end of it, I'm crying. And I'm like, oh my God, what the hell just happened to me? And it was profound. It was life-changing. And I realized I had, she was right. I had been emotionally dead, but I also realized that I could emotionally come alive again with this meditation practice. So then I went to find all the best teachers of it. Now I teach it. Now I'm a master teacher. I teach the teachers and facilitators. And it's like, you know, don't leave before the second miracle happens, right? My first miracle is sobriety. And then I find this practice that's like fantastic. I already kind of had a career, but now I'm also, you know, a meditation teacher. And I'm so grateful to God, to this program. I'm so grateful to have been a part of this, to be alive at this time in this century when this technology. And I also wanted to say the BBA, to me, one of the reasons it's so profound is that it goes deep. It goes deep. I'm going to have a real deep experience. I'm going to be cornered by the truth. Even though it's mostly a mental approach, at some point, I'm going to find my truth. And at some point, hopefully, your heart will engage and you will have that profound feeling of a connection with your higher power that you'll be able to pay forward, you know, to play it forward to others. So thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate your having me here to share. God bless.